supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Our understanding of the heavens going back millennia is more sophisticated than the mere identification of constellations streaming across the night sky. Joining me with details on this episode of Sky Talk is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, the mathematics was sophisticated enough that we were able to predict eclipses with some degree of certainty.
Well, with some degree of certainty. If we look at the record of keeping track of solar eclipses, we know that it goes back, according to record anyway, it goes back to 2136 BC. That particular eclipse, in a sense, is apocryphal in that the story we have about that involves two Chinese astronomers who were responsible for the identification of eclipses for the royal house in China. And in this particular case, it seems that two astronomers missed the prediction of the eclipse and then caused the emperor to be in jeopardy.
Can we look back now with a degree of certainty and know that there was an eclipse in that vicinity around that time?
I think one of the coolest things about the clockwork mechanism of the universe and the human ability to comprehend mathematical concepts is that we're able to know exactly when and where almost every eclipse that could take place in this system can happen. And in fact, it's easily available on the web now. Records of eclipses going back to 1999 BC and forward to 3000 AD, right at your fingertips.
One enduring constant over the millennia is the excitement and anticipation of an eclipse. We had one in the United States a couple of summers back. When's the next one in our area?
You know, the one that we had in 2017 was probably the most observed scientific phenomenon in the history of our observation across the planet. The next one that happens in the United States, meaning, again, that'll be easily accessible to hundreds of millions of people, April 8th, 2024. Although not to the Philadelphia region, the path of totality comes up from the southwestern portion of the United States, streaks across the center and up toward the northeast, but will be outside the band of totality. Not by much. It'll go through the northwestern corner of Pennsylvania, so we're not far away. For Philadelphia, the next time we have totality right here in Center City, 2079.
Oh.
But if you think about it in terms of when the last one happened in Philadelphia, it's relatively nearby. The most recent time we had totality in Philadelphia, 1478.
So that begs the question, what is the definition of totality?
Well, it's that band of the shadow of the moon that passes across the surface of the Earth as the moon slides between the Earth and the sun. The shadow of the moon falling onto the surface of the Earth, that darkest portion is the path of totality. It's about 60 miles wide. So if you're outside of that band of about 60 miles, you're no longer in a situation where the sun's disk is 100% covered by the moon. At 98 to 99%, you still have enough bright sunlight to avoid seeing the totality portion of the eclipse.
Let's fast forward from millennia ago to just under a century ago, the first planetarium went online.
The first planetarium opened in 1923 on October 21st at the Deutsches Museum in Munich, Germany, a museum that the Franklin Institute is modeled after in many, many ways. The Fels Planetarium here in Philadelphia, our own Fels Planetarium, is the second planetarium to open here in the United States in 1934. Since that time, something like nearly 30 million people have sat under the dome of the Fels Planetarium, but the technology has completely changed since that time. Planetaria are now extraordinary digital theaters that are very much different from IMAX in the sense that the planetarium theater has much greater versatility to show almost any format in resolutions that are far higher than most other formats.
Let's consider a future where man goes to Mars. What sort of agricultural equipment would be required to till the soil on the red planet?
There's going to be a lot necessary for that. In fact, the group of researchers at Wageningen University in the Netherlands have grown edible crops using soil simulants for Mars and the Moon in an effort to try to figure out is it actually possible to grow the kinds of vegetation we need on either of these locations? And what they found is that, in fact, you can. You can successfully grow some crops. Radish, spinach, garden cress, quinoa, tomato, rye, chives, leek, and peas were all harvested from both of those soils, the moon and from Mars. Earth soil was used as a control in the experiment. And what was found is that most things grew better in the Martian soil than they did in the lunar soil. However, it was necessary to provide a supplement to the soil, if you will, much like compost, so that all the nutrients that would be necessary would be there for these plants to absorb.
Of course, soil is one factor, but how about other variables like precipitation, radiation, sunlight?
It sounds so easy when you just talk about putting these crops into some soil and hoping they'll grow. Yeah, this would be a major undertaking if you're trying to do this on these extraterrestrial locations because, of course, as you mentioned, water is critically important in this. And even if you figured out a way to do it with a minimal amount of water, that's still a commodity that has to be very, very carefully regulated and managed because there is no regular source of water at any one of these places, even though we talk about water being found in craters on the moon at the extremities, at the two poles of the moon. Still, the amount of water that would be necessary and the amount of land necessary, really, to cultivate enough crops for a reasonable-sized research station on either place would amount to thousands of acres. So this now makes it very, very difficult for us to consider the true possibility of growing what we need to eat.
We have a moment left. What are the October night sky highlights available to be seen this week?
Well, we're in luck. We have a meteor shower that peaks on Tuesday morning. If you happen to be around and able to do it in the hours between midnight and sunrise, that would be the best time to catch the Orionid meteor shower. The meteors in that shower come from the tail and the material of Halley's Comet. And these are meteors that are very, very fast, but not so bright. Occasionally, there's a very bright one that might break up into some fragments that are easily visible, but they're only 10 to 20 per hour, and because they're so fast, it might be difficult to see them easily. Typically, they can leave persistent trains, as they're called, or trails, so that the sky behind them glows for a few seconds longer than usual, and that might help to identify them. But again, 10 to 20 per hour, you'll need very clear skies for that. And again, midnight to sunrise is best, but as soon as the sky gets dark, if you can do that, that will be helpful.
Is that 10 to 20 rate per hour even distinguishable from normal background activity?
That's a great question. The normal background rate is about 10 meteors per hour. So the Orionid shower is 100% greater than the background rate. But when you think of 20 per hour and you sort of divide that through the course of the hour, that comes out to something like 1 every 3 minutes. So maybe not as exciting, but it would be fun to be out in the evening anyway because Jupiter and Saturn still dominate the southwestern sky right after sunset. The moon is still hanging around, although it's rising late. Venus, on the other hand, is just poking its head up from the west right after sunset. It'll be climbing higher into the sky as the season goes on. And if you are up in the morning, between 6:30 and sunrise, you'll find Mars making its most recent appearance over on the eastern side of the sky.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Sky Talk.